Welcome to Week, the political roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California for Tuesday, February 17th, 2015. Thanks for coming out and joining us here tonight in San Francisco. I'm John Zipperer, the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial, and your host for Week to Week. I particularly want to welcome you to today's program because this is our anniversary program. 3 years ago, we launched Week to Week as an experiment to see if we could present intelligent, civil, and even fun political discussion. Now, I know some of you have actually been here from the beginning. I've talked to you, I've seen you, I recognize you. Others have joined us along the way, and some are here for the very first time tonight. We welcome you all, and I thank you all for making Week to Week a healthy, bouncing three-year-old. Also, for anyone who came here tonight expecting to see our third panelist, the San Francisco Chronicle's Deborah J. Saunders, I'm sorry to report that she was not feeling well and had to cancel. Deborah, in fact, was on our very first Week to Week panel, and she has been a frequent panelist here since then. In fact, whenever we go for a while without having Deborah on the panel, I hear from audience members, liberals as well as conservatives, who want to see her again. So don't worry, she will be back, she's on the mend, and you'll get to hear her soon, whether you agree or disagree. So on today's program, we are going to talk about the latest political news, including the very early announcements by California politicians Kamala Harris and Gavin Newsom. President Obama and the GOP-led Congress get down to business. How science is becoming a political issue in the emerging 2016 race, and what the Brian Williams story has to tell us. So, as usual, any opinions that are expressed are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Let's meet our panelists for today. Right next to me is Carla Marinucci, the senior political writer at the San Francisco Chronicle, and she also blogs there for SF Gates' Spin Cycle. She's on Twitter at C. Marinucci. And on the other end of the stage is Bill Whalen, a research fellow at Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He's also a political blogger. You can find his political writing at adayattheracesblog.com. And he's on Twitter at Hoover Whalen. So please use the question cards that are spread throughout the room. So write down, submit your questions, and I will do my best to get as many asked as possible during this program. Now on to our roundtable. Let's start with Gavin Newsom and Kamala Harris. California Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom showed just how forward-thinking he is by announcing his gubernatorial candidacy now, nearly 4 years before the 2018 election. Carla, why would he do that? Is that premature?
Oh, we love this one. I mean, look, it's about money. The guy has a good, a sense of what's needed. He knows this is going to be a crowded race. He's going to have some billionaires in there, maybe one, maybe two. Tom Steyer, maybe Sheryl Sandberg. I keep throwing that name out there in hopes it'll stir things up, you know. But this is going to be crowded. And I think Gavin Newsom wanted to get a good spot in the race. And right now he's already the front runner. And we're talking about him.
So just cancel the election. It's over right now.
Front runner in a... Although, we're starting to hear other, thoughts about people coming in. So,
right.
so he is the front runner for sure.
This is not an unusual Sacramento tactic. If you go into the Secretary of State's page, you'll find all sorts of people who have opened up campaign accounts for campaigns in 2016 and 2018. It's jungle cat politics. You lift your leg and mark your turf, if you will, on the landscape. Gavin Newsom has two nightmares. One is that the legislature outlaws hair product. But the second would be the entrance in the Senate race of one gentleman, Tom Steyer. And why is that? Mr. Steyer, who spent, $75 million, I think, in the last election cycle, he could write himself a check for $50 million and fund a very expensive primary campaign. Gavin Newsom doesn't have that kind of wealth. Some of you might have that wealth, but he doesn't. He has to go out and do it the old-fashioned way, which is beg for it. And in California gubernatorial contest, there is a limit on what you can accept. And the limit, I think, you can max out, I think, at $58,000. That's for both the primary and the general election. So just do the math on how many 58,000 donors out there he'd have to scare up to match Tom Steyer dollar for dollar. Can't happen. So that's why he is out doing this, plus also the fact that he is Lieutenant Governor of California. He has the time to run.
So compare this with Hillary Clinton, who keeps holding off announcing for the for the 2016 presidential race. Are the money politics different? Are the calculations different? Because she, too, would want to lock up big money donors. I think
right now Hillary has a problem on this, and we've heard about it in the last week, where some of these donors, you may be among them, who are getting constant emails from the Ready for Hillary PAC saying, you know, hey, are you ready? Are you in with us? And some of these donors are already saying, look, I'll be ready for Hillary when Hillary's ready for Hillary, okay? She hasn't said she's doing anything yet. And some of these emails are coming, you know, 2 and 3 times a day. The point being, you can wear out your welcome even before you've started. That's what all these folks, whether it's Kamala Harris, whether it's Gavin Newsom or Hillary, have to worry about, which is peaking before, you know, years before the contest even comes. In Kamala Harris's case, the filing deadline isn't even for a year from now. So we're already talking about these people almost daily in our blogs and so forth. The question is, how much can you all take of any of these folks, right?
Yeah, good point. So Hillary's nightmare is not a billionaire to be named later. Her nightmare is Elizabeth Warren. In fact, I believe she and Elizabeth Warren are meeting this week. They've already met this week. Hillary's just playing nice with her, just trying to coax her into, please, do not run against me. Don't do this. Otherwise, it's a remarkably clear Democratic field, the likes of which we've not seen in modern times. Will Rogers famously said, I don't belong to an organized party. I'm a Democrat. And Democrats, presidentially, there's a certain truth to this. They love to have a big field, a lot of first-time candidates, and they sort of thrive on chaos a year out. But this is the antithesis of this. This is the non-chaotic field right now. And so Carla raises a great point. When you don't have competition, when the Republicans are out playing demolition derby with each other, and you don't have competition, how do you stay relevant and how do you stay in the news? Well, emails from the Ready for Hillary PAC, which is not affiliated with her, by the way. It's an independent thing. I signed up for this. Big mistake. You get emails 2 or 3 times a day. Sometimes they want you to buy Ready for Hillary paraphernalia, but otherwise they want money. And it's just like being on an NPR station with a pledge week that never ends. It just you want it to stop.
And I do think that this is an issue that Kamala Harris and Hillary Clinton have in common. Yeah. Neither of them have a robust competitor on the
right.
Republican side. And this is where some Democrats are a little bit worried. We all know that competition makes for better candidates.
Right.
It makes them sharp. It puts them out there on the trail. And they're going to have some kind of honing and some kind of, you know, experience
right.
when it comes to meeting the competition. And neither of them do.
She may have an opponent by the end of the week, though. Antonio Villaraigosa, the former mayor of Los Angeles, has been dropping every hint possible to reporters, to money people in Washington and California that he wants to run. The guess is that he's going to announce maybe as soon as this Friday. And if so, this is a really interesting matchup in the open primary system, because now you have a woman, African-American and Indian, Asian Indian in Kamala Harris, running from the Bay Area. Very popular with African-American voters, obviously, liberals, unions, versus Antonio Villaraigosa, obviously popular with Latinos, from Southern California. It's a great clash to watch. And getting back to the organizational side, here's the question with Kamala Harris. How much of the field has been cleared away from her? How many Democrats have gone to moneyed people, to professional Democrats, and said, I want to run? And how many of them have been discouraged? In other words, do the Democrats just want to clear the field for her and let the chaos carry over in 2018? Or could you get a competitive race with a Harris, with a Villaraigosa, maybe one or two other Democrats to be named later?
So Gavin Newsom's already announced for 2018. We have 2016 to endure first. Assuming we survive 2016, do you think there could be some Democratic, we'll talk to Democrats first and Republicans, Democrats who might go for the Senate seat, and if they don't get it, then weigh in and go after the, you know, challenging Gavin Newsom for
I think people have talked about this with regard to Villaraigosa. He has a timing issue and he has a income issue, frankly. He is not somebody who is independently wealthy. And right now, unlike Kamala Harris, he doesn't have a driver, a state office, etc. He's the former mayor of Los Angeles. He had a lot of business contacts and contracts that he had signed for in the hopes of making money. I think the original plan was, let me make some money and then let me run for governor. However, when Boxer retired, all this, you know, Gavin declared he was going to run for governor. And Kamala jumped in. All of a sudden, people started pressuring him. Look, you're the biggest Latino name in this state. You have a chance to really make this happen. So he has the problem of trying to find how to make a living, frankly, while running for the Senate. A lot of people say he cannot wait to run for governor in 2018 because by then he'll have been out of office right. for years. This is a place, this is a business where what have you done for me lately? He can't wait around that long. So a lot of people feel, as Bill said, I agree. I think he's going to jump in soon because he has to. And if he doesn't, even if he doesn't win, a lot of people say he could run again for governor, although that's unlikely, I think.
Yeah, it's awfully tough. Remember, Richard Nixon ran for president in 1960, and he turned around 2 years later and ran for governor of California. That didn't work out too well. Usually people who run for a statewide office have to take 4 years off in between. Why? Voters are kind of tired of you, and they don't want to see your face coming around another 2 years. Neel Kashkari, who ran for governor here in 2014, he sort of looked briefly at running for 2016 in the Senate, and like Mitt Romney, he went around and asked people about it, and he didn't get a very warm and fuzzy reception. So I think it'd be awfully tough for Antonio to run in 2016, turn around and run again in 2018. And this is the Democratic dilemma, if you will, in that it's too big of a bench, if you will, because these Senate seats come up only once every 25 years. Remember, Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer, first elected in 1992. Think how the world has changed, by the way, since 1992. Now here you are, a quarter of a century later, with these seats opening them up. And a line forms at the rear of Democrats jumping into this for one simple calculation. They know whoever wins these seats may get it for another 25 years. So you better get in now. And you're absolutely right about Antonio. He's been out of office since 2011, I believe. The current mayor of Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti, may run for mayor, or he may run for Senate. So as a former mayor of Los Angeles, you just start to slip into obscurity. So go for it now.
So if you're Gavin Newsom, or if you're advising Gavin Newsom, what would you advise him to do over the next 4 years? For example, he's a, popular Bay Area liberal Democrat, how does he reach out to the rest of the state? Should he be talking legislation and policy, or should he be doing kind of a Hillary Clinton, listening tour, introducing himself to different people? He should be the topic or policy?
On policy issues, Gavin Newsom has been so interesting to watch because in a lot of ways he's been ahead of the curve. He's a very bright guy, and a lot of people I talk to in politics say they know a few people in the business who are such wonks on policy. He really does, drill deep, knows all these issues. In fact, he went down to Hoover and sat there and took questions from those folks and apparently had a good conversation in doing that. I think that, although maybe you have a different view of it, Bill. Your thoughts?
Okay, so again, getting back to the jungle cat side of things, he's got to figure out what turf he wants to mark running for governor. I think he already has one very good issue in his corner, and that is the cost of education at the University of California. He'll tell you that the lieutenant governor of California, it's an interesting job in this respect. We all can make fun of it because lieutenant governor does one thing. He wakes up every morning. He checks to see if the governor has died or not. Finds out the governor has not died and decides, do I go to work or go back to sleep? One or the other. So it's a job, really, that doesn't have a lot of power to it. On the other hand, it sounds great on paper. I'm a lieutenant governor. You sound like Robin to Batman. You sound like I'm Jerry Brown's sidekick. So it attracts voters. But secondly, he can do whatever he wants to. He has a blank canvas to paint here. So he has very cleverly taken advantage of the fact that he sits on the UC Regents Board, and he's gotten into the tuition battle. I would direct him, and I'd push him in one direction, and that's the issue of poverty in California. Poverty plus also the middle class squeeze. This is something I think Jerry Brown realizes that he's a little late to the game on. It's something that's going to be hugely discussed in presidential circles in 2016, who controls the middle class, who talks to it best. But I think if I were Gavin Newsom, I'd probably take a page out of Bobby Kennedy's playbook. And much as Bobby Kennedy discovered poverty in the mid-1960s, going to Appalachia, going to the Deep South. If I were Gavin Newsom, I'd go around parts of California where there's 20 and 30% unemployment and find out what it is to be poor in California, what government can do, and then use that as part of my agenda.
And let's not forget, and a couple of other issues, he's been ahead of the curve, and that's climate change is one. Here in San Francisco, did a lot to making the bus fleets and so forth. He was talking about wind power, wave power, I think long before a lot of other people. On same-sex marriage, of course, he will always be remembered as the guy who in 2004 allowed San Francisco or directed San Francisco city officials to marry same-sex couples. That has gotten him the loyalty of many progressive voters around the country. And this time around, it's legalized marijuana. He is out there already on that issue. And I think that's an area where he has already made news and could get a lot of those millennial voters.
Marijuana legalization will be voted on by you in 2016. It's on the ballot. It's an initiative, a referendum, a referendum, if you want to call it that. Gavin is I need to hashtag that, don't I?
Definitely.
Gavin Newsom is making himself the face of this initiative, at least. He wants to be the face of this initiative. It puts him, interestingly enough, at odds with Jerry Brown, who opposes marijuana legalization. Brown had a great line on this, by the way. They asked him, why do you oppose legalized marijuana? He said, because I've never heard of the, I said, I've never heard anybody utter the words overachieving marijuana user. But Gavin is staking a part of his 2018 fortunes on 2016, and Carla's exactly right. Newsom had a very long statement on his Facebook page announcing that he's running for governor, and one word which I found missing in there, which I can't believe he left out, was the word equality. Which, if I were him, I'd be trumpeting this up and down the state. I was the guy who, in 2004, started the bull on same-sex marriage. I was a Democrat who John Kerry and other Democrats wanted to kill in that election because I was making life difficult for him in Ohio. But I was right in my party, including President Obama, President-to-be Clinton, all came around on this 8 years after I did. So I champion equality. I believe in equality when it comes to same-sex marriage. And you can probably tie marijuana use, if you want to, in some way into equality as well. I'll just make it right now more of an economic message. But I think this is a way for him to get out in front on the civil rights side, because if you're a Gavin Newsom and you're fabulously good-looking and you come from Marin County and, you know, you just look absolutely white, you need to find a way to come around on the civil rights issue. That's one way to do it.
Someone in the audience says Steve Wesley is also planning to run against Gavin. What do you think his chances are?
You know, Steve Wesley is a name that we need to include in this conversation because, of course, he tried to run for governor before. He's somebody who in the tech business is very well respected. He's now sort of venture capitalist and working in Silicon Valley. Very, very smart guy, a guy who could raise money in Silicon Valley. So much depends, I think, on this top two primary, and it is just remade how these races are going to happen. I mean, I think that bill is going to change if Villaraigosa gets into this race in the Senate, and right. There's a Republican in that race. We heard today that Rocky Chavez down in Southern California may get into that race. A Republican is going to mess up Antonio Villaraigosa's plan because if you just come in, you don't have to win the primary anymore. You just have to come in second, right. And then you get into the general, and it's off to the races. If there's no Republican, Villaraigosa can easily make the top two. If there's at least any kind of respected Republican, that likely to come in top two, and the other Democrat is out of the running.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's about multiples. How many Republicans run in the field? If you look, the field poll has a survey coming out tonight on the Senate race, and it shows that life is very good if you happen to be one of two people, Kamala Harris or Condoleezza Rice. Condoleezza Rice actually finishes ahead of Kamala Harris. It wasn't a head-to-head poll. They just asked people who they're interested in being a senator, and there's Condi at the top of the list. But in a 2016 Senate race, part of the Villaraigosa thinking is this. He probably can't catch Harris. He won't have the institutional help. He won't have the financial edge he will have. It's all about, as Carla mentioned, finishing second. So do the math. If you have three or four or five Republicans all going at it, which could very well happen because there's no definitive Republican candidate dwarfing the others, then that dilutes the Republican field. So now you're talking about a bunch of people getting 5 to 12% of the vote. Very easy for him to slip into second place and thus make it to November. And then, at which point then you get to November, and here's Villaraigosa, who is a very experienced lawmaker, mayor of Los Angeles, speaker of the state assembly before that, a lot of chevrons on his sleeve, versus Kamala Harris, who is rather blank slate when it comes to policy.
A couple more questions from the audience before we move on to our next topic. Someone writes that Gavin is a strong candidate, but this person really cares about the anti-fracking issue. So do we know what his views are and how those might play in the race?
I don't know where he is on fracking. That's a good question. One thing which will get him into trouble in a Democratic primary, and this again is why he is raising money early, is because he opposes the choo-choo. He opposes the high-speed rail. That puts him not just at odds with the governor, but it puts him at odds with unions in California because high-speed rail, at the end of the day, is a massive labor project. And this is part of his thinking. He imagines that a labor super PAC some very large labor independent expenditure is going to slay him. But fracking, I don't know. That's a good question.
This is a big issue
in Sacramento this year, by the way, because the governor has kind of a, sort of to call a modified limited hangout position on fracking. He is pro-fracking, but with a lot of concerns. And that's kind of a beautiful way of saying, I believe we should move forward on something, at the same time just kind of killing it with a thousand cuts.
Okay, you brought up the governor. Governor Jerry Brown, Gavin Newsom, the lieutenant governor, are not famously close political friends. Do you think the governor will endorse Gavin Newsom during the primaries? No.
I don't think he'll endorse. Jerry Brown is a lone wolf when it comes to Democratic politics. Can we not agree on this?
Yes, yeah,
this
absolutely.
Is somebody who did not campaign for the Democrats. This is somebody who did not campaign for Steve Glazer here in the Bay Area, who's running for the Assembly over in the East Bay. He is his own man, and I don't think he'll step into the
primaries. Yeah, I think Jerry Brown still has harsh feelings with regard to when Gavin ran for governor back in 2000. When was it? 2008? His campaign was, I'm the future, he's the past, something to that effect. Going right to Jerry Brown's age, it did not go over well.
It's a deliciously personal feud, if you will, because, yes, Newsom and Brown went at it in the Democratic primary, though Newsom dropped out pretty early. But also, they're both products of San Francisco. And Gavin Newsom, either his godfather is from the Brown family or Newsom's father.
There's family ties.
And what Newsom will tell you is that Brown sort of patronizes him. He kind of sees Gavin Newsom as a kid at all times. He sees him as a little kid he knew growing up and doesn't treat him sufficiently as an adult, although they have come they're on the same side on the tuition debate at UC, so there is a little common ground here.
Okay. Someone asks if you think Gavin Newsom declared his intention to run for governor to clear the decks for other Democratic candidates to run for and go after Barbara Boxer's Senate seat. You don't think he's trying to clear the decks for...
No, not this early. I just think he's trying to... He has to raise money.
Well, actually, you're closer to this than I am. Kamala Harris and Gavin Newsom have the same consultant, no?
That's right. A. Smith, SEN Strategies, who also has worked for Hillary Clinton and Barbara Boxer.
And Newsom's announcement and Kamala's came...
Yeah, there was
together.
A feeling early on that these two could not go for the same seat. They had the same followers. They had the same donors. They were going to have to come to some kind of agreement. How that was done, we may never know. But the fact is they both realized that the competition was going to be a bloody mess, and they were going to have to decide which one to run for.
Well, let's talk some more on the national political side. And actually, before this we came out here, Carly, you were talking about we're already seeing kind of a string of potential candidates come in to the Bay Area. Actually, what do we have just coming up in the next week or so?
This week alone, we've got Bobby Jindal coming to he's coming to California. Was supposed to do three fundraisers here on Thursday, actually. And, of course, he's one of the highest-ranking Indian-American legislators in the country and governors. Was going to go to Fremont, Palo Alto, that's Silicon Valley, raise money. But I have to say he's raised a little bit of concern among the Indian American community I've been hearing today, because he last month made some statements about assimilation, saying, I'm not a hyphenated American, I'm an American. If my parents wanted to stay me to be Indian, they would have stayed in India. And that is not going over well with a lot of the people I'm hearing in the Indo-American community who are saying, look, we're a vital, we love, our roots are very important to us. We're Americans, but, this comment went over as condescending and even insulting to some of them.
Yeah, he has several challenges if he wants to run for president. One is getting people to forget that horrible memory of him giving that response to the State of the Union in 2009, I think it was. I don't know if you remember or not. He's the governor of Louisiana, and he gave the Republican response, which is just a losing proposition because whoever you are, you look terrible compared to the president. His was particularly bad. The visuals on it were ugly. He just kind of came jumping out of the screen at you. It was scary theater. First
wasn't as bad as Marco Rubio swilling water bottles during the
They really should just do away with this tradition. It's a lose-lose. So that's problem number one. First memories sometimes last longest. Problem number two is he comes from an oil and gas state. He's the governor of Louisiana. I filled up my car with gas today in Palo Alto. A high test is $3.09. That's wonderful for us. That's terrible for Louisiana. So he has an economy that's about to go south very fast. Problem number three, though, is there are a lot of Republican governors sniffing at the presidency right now. And Chris Christie has been looking at this. Christie is out here in Sacramento next week speaking to the California Republican Party's convention. You have Scott Walker, who is running. John Kasich, the governor from Ohio, is looking at this. Jindal's moment may have passed already, not getting in line earlier, and he may have lost his seat to Scott Walker already, even though we're still 11 months out from the Iowa caucuses.
You know, and some of the Democratic consultants I'm talking to out here are already saying Scott Walker's the guy they fear the most in this whole thing. That Jeb Bush, we just saw recently, spoke to an auto dealers convention here in San Francisco. Boy, that was the whitest, malest convention I've ever seen anywhere, I have to say. But Jeb Bush did a very good job, looked at ease there, I thought. It's going to be really interesting to see Chris Christie out here next week, yeah, because he has had just outright just hatred toward Governor Brown and has said so. It's the kind of red meat he's going to throw at the Republican Party. I can't wait to see that. And Hillary comes out next week, and she's going to be speaking to a women's convention in Silicon Valley. This is one of the many she's done here in the Bay Area. And, of course, the convention people won't tell us if she's being paid or not, which means she's being paid. And a lot, probably.
A lot.
Yeah.
Well, while those folks are seeking the office, there is still someone who's in the White House. I think his name is President Obama. Back in December on this program, we were trying to predict how this Democratic president would work with or around the newly Republicanized Congress, if you will. We now have a month or so of a track record since Congress came back and the new congressional session began. So let's talk about what they've done, what they haven't done, what they might do. First, Bill, I think a lot of folks expected the GOP to make the president's time very difficult in terms of nominations and approving those, but we just saw a Secretary of Defense nomination go through pretty easily, didn't we?
Yeah, Gordon Ash, who was a Hoover Institution research fellow, he is the new Secretary of Defense. It sailed through without a problem. The Attorney General, I think, is going to also sail through without a problem. You would have thought that maybe Ted Cruz would have body blocked that one, but they're going to let that one go by as well. And this is one of the many curious things about the Republican existence on Capitol Hill. On the one hand, they get it. They realize that blocking nomination fights is oftentimes a losing proposition. The public doesn't really zero in on what you're trying to do. You look obstructionist and mean it's bad politics. That much they get. At the same time, though, they managed to box themselves into a really bad corner. And that was Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate, saying that they were not going to shut down the government. We're not going to relive the old days. Well, next week, February the 27th, we're looking at a shutdown of the Department of Homeland Security. It's a partial shutdown. You know, necessary government people stay alive in a shutdown, and DHS will not shut down. But that said, that now they're in a political argument over shutdowns. So they're boxed in that corner. Third thing, and this drives me crazy about the Republicans on the Hill, they don't read the Constitution. The Constitution has very strict language about separation of powers. And the president has executive authority. Congress has legislative powers. Congress cannot take away the president's executive authority, and yet this Congress insists on trying to take away his executive authority. There's a simple solution to undoing the president's executive authority. It's called winning presidential elections.
Let's talk about it. We just saw some judicial action on one of his.
Yeah, I mean,
explain what happened
in the last 2 days. A Texas judge basically has blocked the president on the executive action on immigration. Right. This was all supposed to go into effect this week. People are putting in applications. This is the DACA, the Deferred Action for Children. Basically, millions of immigrants are sort of in legal limbo because of this Texas judge decision. I just did a story tomorrow for the Chronicle and talked to people here in the city of San Francisco and elsewhere. They said, look, this isn't going to stop us. This is not going to deter us. We expect this to be overturned, although the Fifth Circuit, I understand, is a very conservative group of folks.
It's going to the Supreme Court.
But it may go to the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, these immigrant rights groups here in San Francisco and elsewhere are saying they are moving ahead with these applications. Yeah. They do not want this to deter in any way having millions of people come out of the shadows. Apparently 3 million in California alone. California has more undocumented immigrants than any other state. So this is a big one. The executive action on immigration is just one of the reasons why we had President Obama here in town last week, and I did some stories on that, and I have to say the Democrats, boy, what a difference a few executive actions and State of the Union address makes, because you talked to Democrats last November for the midterms, and it was like you've lost that love and feeling, you know. And this week it's like drunken love. Everybody just loves the guy. And, you know, they're talking to Democrats this week. They were, you know, saying he's brought sexy back. You know, they love the executive actions. They love what he's doing in Washington, the tone. And I happen to be the pool reporter, which means one of the few reporters that could go into the fundraiser that he did this week in San Francisco in a very small living room at Sandy Robertson's house, a big billionaire. So I got to hear his spiel to these, you know, 50 donors. And basically it was, you know, I'm only here for the next 2 years, and 2 years can be a long time, but I'm out there. I'm going to be working, you know, working my butt off for the next presidential election and for the next 10 years. And these people were very fired up. They thought it was great. I mean, he's setting the table for whatever's ahead.
This is like going down to Pier 39 and throwing fish to the seals. These are people who paid $30,000 to $100,000. So my question is, what do these people eat at the end? What do they serve? Fish. Here's your fish. No, it's so the immigration thing is first of all, there is an injunction right now, and the injunction is going to lead eventually to a Supreme Court decision. And we talk a lot about what's going to happen if there's a Hillary Clinton, Jeb Bush 2016 election, if there's a showdown between those two. And one thing you always hear is, my God, you know, conservatives won't bother to vote because they really don't like Jeb Bush. Liberals, some liberals have issues with Hillary Clinton. They're not going to turn out. There is a simple reason for both sides to turn out, and it's called the Supreme Court. Right now it's a 5-4 court that swings either way. Sometimes it swings conservatively. Sometimes it swings to the left. On Obamacare, for example, it's a 5-4 court. There are two justices who may be up before the president leaves office. One is Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is not 100% sober at the State of the Union. That is my favorite. It sounds so like Bill Clinton, by the way.
That is a quote, by the way, from her.
Doesn't that sound like Bill Clinton, though? Have you ever been drunk, Mr. President? I've never been 100% sober. You know, just so Clintonian. But Obama gets two picks on the court, replacing Democratic picks with Democratic picks, possibly. The next president probably gets two. One is Kennedy, who's a swing vote. The other is probably Scalia, who's getting up there in age. Depending on who wins the next presidential race, Republican or Hillary, it could end up being a 5-4 court. It could be a 6-3 liberal court, a 6-3 conservative court. And consider the difference between a conservative court and a liberal court on something like the executive order. So, you know, the court is very high stakes in 2016 and doesn't get talked about. But with Obama, so Obama landed across the street from me at Stanford. I live right across the field where he landed. And this was a trip which, at least on the Stanford campus, was more about the process than about the actual event. The president signed an executive order. How many of you know exactly the executive order was? Nobody really? Yeah, this is really more about him coming to California and being here. And this is an interesting part of the Obama legacy as far as this state is concerned. He had a potential to really weigh in on a lot of California-specific things. He should be over at Berkeley right now talking about diversity, higher education, the cost of education in California. Instead, he went to Stanford to talk about cybersecurity. A valid issue, but he's been away from the Berkeley issue, which is important. He has been to Oakland to raise money time and again at the Fox Theater. He has never weighed in on civil strife in Oakland. Then again, he didn't really weigh in on Ferguson that much either. I just think part of the Obama legacy is going to be very complicated. Historians have been looking at it recently. Right now, he's ranked about 18th among presidents. 43 gentlemen who've held the office, so he's kind of middle of the pack. He gets high marks for doing Obamacare. It's historic. But what's interesting is the partisan divide within the 18th ranking. Conservatives really dislike him. Liberals really like him. I think as we look at him in the years after his presidency, part of the legacy, fair or unfair, is going to be missed opportunities. And so I look at these events like when it comes to California, and okay, it's valid to do cybersecurity, but he should be doing so much more than just coming out and raising
money. Yeah, I agree with you. And I think this is where, even though progressives were really glad to see him here, they liked him a lot since the State of the Union. I heard a lot of grousing about why isn't he going to Berkeley or Chabot College? He's talking about community colleges and how important they are, and yet, you know, in audiences at Stanford, I guarantee you, not one of those people had ever been to a Walmart. You know, I mean, where's the you know, the average American? And when you saw this, you know, the appeal to average Americans too. I have to say, being the pool reporter on this event, after we did the fundraiser at Sandy Robertson's house, the press pool had to go to in the motorcade, and they said, oh, the president's making an unannounced stop. Okay, well, where's that? So we all followed to the restaurant Spruce here in Pacific Heights, which, if any of you have been there, is not exactly an average American, $42 for duck. I mean, come on. And chocolate mohair walls. I mean, that's the kind of place that very few average Americans can get inside. So I think you are right when it comes to some of the messaging. And we sat there, for 2.5 hours while he ate inside with friends.
Did he send anything out to the cars?
No, he did not. No. So there. So this average American had to eat on the go.
This is what incumbents do versus candidates. A candidate would have fit.
A little less on elections and some of the actual issues folks are living with. Some of the things that we've seen in Congress and the White House, I want to get into. One is the president has asked Congress to authorize military force that he's already taking. So, Carla, what are we likely to see?
We just saw some polls today. I mean, the Americans are not happy with the way the president is handling these issues. Every day, I can't recall a story like this. The visuals on this story that Americans are seeing every day with regard to YouTube, how social media has changed the story in the respect that it's the Republicans who want to give the president more muscle, right, and it's the Democrats who want to pull back on this. And I think it's creating a real dilemma in Washington every time there's a new attack, every time there's more killings, and ISIS is just beyond any kind of story that we've ever seen before, and how to handle it, I think, is the dilemma here. And the polls are, what we've seen in the polls is Americans are not really happy with the way the president's handling it.
Yeah, dilemma is the key word here. There is no easy policy fix here. Airstrikes, death from above, probably is not going to solve it entirely. You probably have to go in and tear it out at the roots. That means putting people on the ground. Put people on the ground, people are going to start dying. You're going to have bodies coming home to America. People don't want that as well. People say, well, let's turn this over to the Kurds and let the Kurds take this over. Well, you give the Kurds too many weapons, and the Kurds are going to break away from Iraq, and then Turkey's going to go crazy and so forth. So no easy solutions. And so this is where Republicans have to tread lightly, I think, in this one, in fairness. Yes, the president has a tendency to be behind the curve on a lot of foreign policy decisions with ISIS, with Putin and Ukraine. He tends to lead from behind, I think, is a legitimate criticism. But there is no simple fix to this when it comes to ISIS. And I think as a reporter, this is a great question to ask each and every candidate out there. Okay, sir, ma'am, what is your fix?
What about trade deals? The U.S. is negotiating a big trade deal with Europe. That deal might be even more controversial in Europe than it is here, especially to French farmers, for example. Bill, I mean, do you know, is that an area where the Republicans and the White House might cross the aisle?
Yeah, hell freezes over. This is where the president, the Republicans of Congress have common ground. So the question then is, the president wants to do trade agreements, how much do fellow Democrats in Congress push back against it? Does Nancy Pelosi, for example, make noise on it?
Yeah, in fact, Commerce Secretary Penny Pritzker was here on Friday. I talked to her. She was in San Francisco trying to sell these trade deals to Democrats in San Francisco, essentially. I mean, going to small businesses, talking about how little bike shops, restaurants and so forth are all going to be helped by these kind of trade deals, that they create jobs and so forth. That was her message after she did the cybersecurity thing. So for the Obama administration, these trade deals are important, but then you've got issues like this port closure issue going on, billions of dollars at stake. And that was another issue where at least President Obama out here didn't have a word to say about it.
Right.
I was a little surprised on that. She did, Penny Pritzker did, but at stake were a lot of jobs and a lot of business and small business being really affected by that. It looks like these the ships are being unloaded again now.
Right.
But this is really a crisis when you talk about dozens and dozens of ships being lined up with perishable goods and not being unloaded in the California ports.
Had enough politics? Let's talk measles. Now, I had this on my list of something I wanted to bring up, both how political leaders are dealing with measles, vaccination, science. This is a question from the audience, so don't get mad at me. Have Chris Christie and Rand Paul disqualified themselves by sounding like Marin Kooks on the topic of vaccination? We should explain a bit here. How to get into someone get the Marin folks mad at me. As you know, there's been an outbreak of measles, and it's been connected to some unvaccinated folks who went to Disneyland.
Right.
And where this has really gotten a lot of heat is folks who, for example, are not vaccinated for medical reasons, either the child's too young or the person's going through chemotherapy, I think, is some of the reasons. So certain politicians then have started actually coming out and saying, no, 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 vaccination is important. Hillary Clinton came out and tweeted that. Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, did that. But Chris Christie and Rand Paul, I mean, Bill, what did they do? What was their take on it?
Their take was they left the door open to not being very comfortable with science. In other words, there has been, when this gets into the vaccine argument with autism, which was actually a very hot issue in the 2008 campaign, then candidates Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama very much left the door open saying, well, I'm very concerned that vaccines could possibly have bad repercussions. So they both said we need to investigate this. That quickly got glossed over, but this has come back now to haunt Paul, who's an ophthalmologist, and Christie, who's not an eye doctor by any means. And this is a Ralph Cramden moment. Those of you who grew up watching The Honeymooners on TV probably remember Ralph Cramden, always caught in a bad situation, would always try to think up an answer and always go, humana, 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 humana. And when you run for office, you run for president, you need a lot of skills. God knows you need patience to suffer through life. Carl, every day, you need a lot of stamina just to get up every morning. You need to be able to put a smile on your face and suffer fools gladly. You also need to be able to think on your feet. And what happened to Governor Christie, what happened to Senator Paul, and what also happened to Governor Walker when he went to London and was asked about evolution, and 2 days later came up with a reasonable answer, they had what I would call humana, humana, humana moments, in which they're all trying to figure out how to placate the crowd. I have a theory as to what happens here, and it's a one-word answer. It's called Iowa. The state of Iowa, for Republicans, has the first-in-the-nation caucuses, February 1st of next year. The state of Iowa's caucuses for Republicans is overwhelmingly conservative in its vote. It's social conservatives, it's religious conservatives, it's conservative with a capital C. And it leads to this sort of humana humana that you see among these candidates. Hillary Clinton kind of nailed it. Now, granted, she had 4 years to figure out the right answer here, but she put out a tweet saying that science has shown this, get over it, let's move on. But the problem for Republicans is simply this. Even though they're unfairly tagged on the issue of measles, because if you look at California, what are the two biggest anti-vaccine parts of California? It's Marin County and Santa Monica. Ain't no Republicans around there, I can guarantee you.
it's true.
But it's Republicans who suffer with the label of being the anti-science crowd. And so this is the briar patch that Governor Christie has thrown himself into, and Senator Paul and Governor Walker. Does it disqualify them as Marin County kooks or brand them as such? No, I don't think it disqualifies them. But again, first impressions, it's just a bad thing to find yourself to dig out of. In the case of Christie, it's sort of repeat concussion syndrome. Just you have problems over this. You have problems over Bridgegate. You have problems hugging Barack Obama on a beach. You have problems looking silly wearing a yellow sweater at Dallas Cowboys games. It just it adds up to a bad metaphor if you're Christie.
And I have to say, on the vaccine issue, this is where Rand Paul, Christie, any of them who want to fundraise in Silicon Valley, how do you go to Silicon Valley, home to the world's greatest science, etc., and try to suggest vaccines or evolution? Yeah. I just think that creates a real dilemma for them.
Yeah, Silicon Valley is one of the areas with pretty high non-vaccination rates.
Yeah, no, exactly. There is an interesting issue there that when you're talking about Santa Monica, Marin County, you're talking about some very highly educated folks. I wonder if that's going to change. If that opt-out rate is going to change based on the amount of information and education we've seen in the last couple of weeks on this. I think it may shift. And there have been actual suggestions of movements to shame people who don't vaccinate their kids. So I wonder if this, where this is all going to go from a cultural standpoint as well.
Yeah. Talking about Republicans being tarred as anti-science and such, I did want to kind of virtually bring in Deborah Saunders to this program because I had emailed her and said, well, can you give us a comment? I'll read it during the program. So Deborah writes, The fact that the Washington Post did a story about Walker dropping out of college and the New York Times did a story on his proposed University of Wisconsin cuts only through the prism of the 2016 elections,
right.
That shows that Beltway journalists see him as a top contender. I don't know if he should be nominee, but the fact that he is getting the treatment says something. Bill, what does it say about your party?
Well, Scott Walker goes to Iowa last month. He gives a speech at something called the Freedom Forum or Freedom Summit. I'm personally terrified by anything that has the word freedom in it. It's usually a scary outfit. And he gives a very good speech by all accounts, and he's supposedly a dull speaker, and he surprised everybody with the lights-out speech, and so he takes off in Iowa. The next thing you know, a poll comes out, and he's at the front of the pack in Iowa. He's now the flavor of the moment. So I'm not sure if I agree with Deborah that they're writing these stories about him because they want to kill him in the cradle. I think it's more the fact that he's at the top of the poll, so okay, we're going to peel off the layers and see what we have here. Scott Walker attended Marquette. And he left in his fourth year, does not have a college degree. The last American president not to have a college degree would be? George Washington. He did not have a college degree. Did they have college back then? Yes. Harry S. Truman, last president without a college degree. So he is walking in Truman-esque tracks here. So these stories were twofold. One was, can we elect a president without a college degree? And I think people like Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg have gotten by in life without a college degree. But the second story is, okay, is there really kind of any fire to the smoke that he left early? In other words, is he hiding something? Was he kicked out? What have you? But this is just the wonderful world of journalism that you get into when you're a political candidate.
But I also just want to add, you mentioned Iowa so many times, and I've covered the Iowa caucuses several times now, and I just remember, when you talk about Iowa being its own universe and its own little sort of laboratory
right.
for politics, I mean, I just remember going there in 2008 when Mike Huckabee was really hot. I think he won the Iowa caucuses right. that year. But we were there for New Year's Eve with Mike Huckabee because the Iowa caucuses were like 1 or 2 days right after. This New Year's Eve party just showed me how Iowa is not like California in any way in any politics, because he had the huge turnout for his party. He was playing guitar the whole nine yards. And they had a huge open bar for New Year's Eve. Totally empty. Nobody drinking at this New Year's Eve party. I was like, this really isn't California yeah. in any way.
I have to say, when Mike Huckabee came here and spoke to the Commonwealth Club during the 2008 primaries, everyone I knew who at all interacted with him, whether they were dyed-in-the-wool Democrats or Republicans, they loved him. I mean, just on a personal level. Not, oh, they're going to vote for him, but...
Can I tell my favorite Huckabee story?
Please.
Okay, so Huckabee runs in 2008. He wins Iowa. He surprises everybody. He doesn't get far beyond Iowa. The campaign doesn't have legs. But he's seen as this kind of delightfully surprising, folksy candidate. Roger Ailes at Fox News, in his infinite wisdom, who knows a good opportunity and sees it, he signs him to a contract, and Huckabee has his own show where he has people on and plays music, and it's about the squarest thing you ever see on TV, but but now he has left Fox News to campaign. In 2012, Huckabee was thinking about running, and he and Ailes went out to dinner to talk this over, because if he were to run for president, he'd have to step away from Fox News. So they're talking this over at dinner. Toward the end of dinner, Huckabee turns to Ailes and he says, okay, you know, I'm thinking about running. If I do, what do I need to do? And Ailes is just incredibly blunt about things in life, looks at him and he goes, well, you've gotten fat in the last 4 years. You're gonna have to lose 25 pounds. At which point I'm told the waiter walks up and says, dessert, and Huckabee says, I'll have the cheesecake. Translation, I'm staying at Fox, I'm not running.
Okay, well, to take a sort of detour from politics then and talk about, it has not been a good month for journalists. Deaths recently of the New York Times' David Carr and CBS's Bob Simon.
Yeah.
And, of course, the brouhaha over Brian Williams. NBC News anchor Brian Williams found himself off the air now for, 6 months?
Right.
Yeah.
Following revelations that at least one story he told was not true. So, Carla, what was the story that got him in trouble? Why was this untruth so troubling to people?
Yeah, I mean, for Brian Williams, it was a story about being under fire as a correspondent in Iraq.
Iraq.
I'm so torn on this in a way. I do think, you know, I agree with our editorial page editor, John Diaz, who said, yes, he had to resign or quit, or at least should be off the air, because you can't tell stories on NBC Nightly News or on the David Letterman show without the credibility factor for all news media. This is something that reflected on all of us, I think, and it was deeply felt in among my community of people because, in one respect, Brian Williams is a solid news guy. He has been a guy as a reporter. He's not just a anchor man, as a Will Ferrell anchor man. He was somebody who really was out in the field and did a lot of super solid reporting. So in my view, it was really tragic to see. In one respect, he didn't make unlike Dan Rather's error, which was a real error in reporting. He didn't do that, but he did something that just really can't be forgiven, which was to just tell a story just ruin its credibility. The credibility factor was the key.
But here's the problem. He's not a newsman. He's a news personality. Now, that's the phrase we use, news personality. And Brian Williams is still on the air. You can go on Hulu and look up 30 Rock episodes, and you'll find Brian Williams. You can go on Hulu and look up Jimmy Fallon repeats and find Brian Williams and Letterman repeats. This is Brian Williams being a news personality, if you will. Not an anchor man or a newsman, but a news personality. Part of being a personality is you tell stories. And you start telling stories, they become more embellished over the years. So it wasn't that I was in Iraq and it was dangerous. I was in Iraq and I took fire. I was in Iraq and they threw an RPG at me. And it becomes more embellished. Yeah. And then you just start going through it. It's like a classic political scandal in that you find the tip of the iceberg and you start digging deeper. And it's not just Iraq. It's, he was covering Hurricane Katrina and talked about a dead body floating by that wasn't there. Happy Mardi Gras, by the way. And then apparently he had expense account problems at NBC and other embellishment problems, and on it goes. So he is on the sidelines for 6 months, and I'm just going to throw one crazy theory out there. I'm guessing this is what's going on. First of all, NBC, because it's the NBC News with Brian Williams, it's him. They're wed to him. They have to see if they can ride this out for 6 months. So in other words, this gives them time to see what else is out there, how many more shoes drop. At the same time, I'm guessing that Brian Williams' lawyers and NBC's lawyers are having some rather candid conversations because Williams just signed a contract not too long ago. He signed a 5-year, $50 million contract. Newsmen don't get paid $10 million a year. News personalities get paid $10 million a year. I imagine that Williams' lawyers and NBC's lawyers are going through the fine details of that contract and seeing how much money if he gets if he steps down, how much money he gets if he gets fired, and how much money in between if he agrees to part ways mutually. So.
But I think one of the dilemmas here is, yes, Brian Williams was a news personality, but didn't NBC want him? Didn't they create him to be? He was out there on these shows selling the NBC product, which they wanted him to do.
This is what drives you people crazy about the electronic people, in that it's not just about being a good reporter and following a deadline. There's got to be a personality here. So it's not just Williams reporting the news. He's got to go on Letterman and Fallon, and he has to do skits and all that.
And pump the ratings up for NBC, which he did. They were number one. Yep. And so that's what I think the interesting aspect is. He was doing what they wanted him to do, but you're right. Embellishing the stories.
The most fascinating side of this to me, by the way, is how Tom Brokaw has just absolutely refused to come to his rescue, and as if anything, has just kicked him while he's been down.
Yeah, so absolutely.
There's some bad blood behind it. Did you watch the Saturday Night Live special, by the way, on Sunday? This is one of the funniest moments, but Jerry Seinfeld came out and mentioned that Brian Williams was one of the original members of the Not Ready for Primetime Players, and the audience, which is full of NBC executives, is all like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good joke.
Again, Deborah Saunders recently wrote in the American Spectator that there's a different standard that we have for journalists and for politicians, and we'll be bipartisan here. We remember, the story of Ronald Reagan supposedly helping to, visiting the death camps after World War II or something, and he was never there, or Hillary Clinton being under fire in Bosnia or something like that.
Deborah wrote about this in I thought, a very effective way, and she said, she pointed out one of the main dangers of what I do, today in the social media age, what all of us in the news media do, which is we are being pressured to be out there on social media, on Twitter, on Facebook, and so forth, and every one of these venues takes you away from what you really want to be doing, which is reporting, and you have to just constantly keep yourself focused on what your mission is and not be distracted by all this other stuff. And I think it's very hard to do more and more it's hard to do because that becomes part of the whole marketing of your product. And I think this is where journalists and reporters have got to get back to the main event, which is public information, accountability, really looking behind the curtain, and stop being distracted by the BS of social media.
Did you all see the story about David Axelrod, the former, I think he's former, he's no longer an advisor to President Reagan, and one of the things he, in his new book, I guess, is him saying that President Obama lied during the 2012 election about his support for gay marriage. He kind of did the old, no, it's man and a woman, please don't ask me, and then he evolved his opinion afterward. And that story comes out, and you know, it is a totally different standard. People are like, well, of course he lied. He's a politician.
Right.
You know, we don't expect them to. And that's
yeah. I mean, you see the polls on the public and what they think of the credibility of any of these folks. I mean, every day we see examples of this, and you're right. We're all responsible in some respects for the cynicism out there with regard to media and with regard to politics.
Well, we're glad you took time off from reporting to come to our stage. let's do some more of your questions before we get to the news quiz. Why do you think President Obama did not make a timely appearance after the Chapel Hill shootings? This were the killings of three Muslim students in North Carolina. This is even though the Dems love him right now. Was that another missed chance?
No, he put out a statement. So he actually waited on it and got himself in the news cycle. And actually that drove the right crazy because the right said that he was more concerned about the shooting at Chapel Hill than he was about the beheadings in the Middle East. So
the
president can't win for losing sometimes. But the president engaged in it. You don't have to always go on camera if you're the president to make news. If you utter words about something, it gets reported, and then you're in the story.
You mentioned the governor and the lieutenant governor on UC tuition. Someone asked, do you think the UC tuition increase is well understood by California taxpayers, and do you think it will be implemented? Any thoughts on that?
Implemented, I don't know. I think this is still a chapter to be written, but I think in terms of being well understood, I think this is going to be an issue in these races coming up. I think this is something that hits so many people and middle-class Californians in the pocketbook. This goes to the whole income inequality issue, and I think we absolutely haven't heard the end of it. On the implementation, I don't know. This is a tug of war here between Janet Napolitano and Jerry Brown where it goes. It goes to finances.
It goes to finances. Last week, I think it was reported that the revenue is about $1 billion ahead of forecast right now. And I suspect that there's more money than they anticipated that it's getting used to things like papering over this. This strikes me as a deal between Brown and Napolitano waiting to happen, that they'll get together, they'll put money into it, and she'll probably, in agreement for money to keep the tuition increase not going into effect, she'll agree some reforms to the system that Brown wants in terms of administrative functions and overhead and things like that.
Okay, Bill, you mentioned the executive order Obama signed. How do you view, this was the cybersecurity executive order, right? How do you view that? What was it about?
What's it about? It's about government working closer with the private sector to get onto cybersecurity. I'm not an expert on cybersecurity, so I could go on the details. But the president comes out to Stanford, and he wanted to do more than just give a speech. So he signed the executive order, which I think just creates more partnerships. This is one of the reasons, by the way, why he came to Stanford, because Stanford is, you know, for decades now, been receiving a lot of federal research money for computer science research, and so it's just the natural tie-in.
Okay, here's a question from someone who wants to avoid their email for the next 4 years. How impactful do you think online political activity will be in 2016 and onward? It's never upward, isn't it?
I think. I mean, this is going to be the difference. This is one of the reasons why Gavin Newsom is so ahead of the curve already on this race so many years away. He's got 1.2 million Twitter followers. He's one of the most followed politicians in the world. Go look at the list of Twitter, top Twitter. He's not Katy Perry, but he's not too bad either. This is every politician is discovering this, and there isn't one of them who isn't going to be out there. And on fundraising, particularly, they're tracking where you're at on Facebook, what you're liking, what groups you follow, and everything is being watched in terms of the groups that start hitting you for fundraising.
Yeah, there's a new phrase in politics. It's called money bomb. And money bomb is last-minute fundraising, which is done primarily by the Internet. You might remember Scott Brown when he ran for Senate in Massachusetts to replace Ted Kennedy. He was one of the pioneers in doing this, and the money bomb for him was as much Internet fundraising as you could do around the country, and you collect as much money as you can, and then you spring it out on reporters, and they say, oh, my God, he raised $500,000 over the Internet. Wowza. So, yeah, you're right. It's going to just keep growing as people. One reason being people becoming more comfortable with the Internet and now becoming a little more comfortable, even though the cybersecurity concerns, over, you know, giving money over the Internet. So it's another outlet for money in politics. Yay.
Very good. Well, thank you. Let's go to our news quiz now. And if Colette, our prize deliverer, would come up here. What we're going to do, for those of you who have not been here for a news quiz before, I'm going to ask a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. Please don't just shout it out. Raise your hand. I'll call on you. Then you can shout it out. And if you're right, Colette will deliver unto you a little chocolate prize. So the first question. What did former President Jimmy Carter say would be the focus of the rest of his life? What did he say he was going to make a priority for to work on for the rest of his life? Did any of you see this? I can see by all the hands that you did not. Do you have a guess? No, but that's been a long time one. In the back there, sir. No. He might well be working on that, but that's not what he said. Sir. Nope. Nobody saw this story, I can tell. Way in the back. That's right. He's going to devote the rest of it for improving rights and treatment of women and girls around the world. Thank you, George.
No Googling.
Don't worry. We've got other questions. Okay. So, next question. Egypt launched airstrikes against ISIS in Libya in retaliation for what? And sir, right there, you. That's right. They beheaded 21 Egyptian Christians. Next question. European leaders rejected calls, but from whom, that all Jews should emigrate to Israel? Sir, in the dark shirt. You, yes. Benjamin Netanyahu, Israeli's prime minister. That's correct. Here's a question. A proposed law would make California the first state to require adults to wear what for safety? Keep it clean. Ed, sir, I saw your hand first. Bicycle helmets, that's correct.
That's right.
Yes, they'll have to wear bicycle helmets. We would be the first state for adults. House Speaker John Boehner said he was prepared to let what government department shut down over a budget disagreement? Ma'am, I saw your hand first. The Department of Homeland Security, that is correct. And let's see. Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei has weighed in with his movie thoughts ahead of the Academy Awards. I know this. You're probably keeping score of what he likes and doesn't like. Well, what film did he criticize because he said it could inspire anti-Muslim violence? Ma'am, American Sniper, that's correct. And Colette, how many do we have left? Four more questions. Okay. So, streets in the San Francisco neighborhood of North Beach were shut down on Sunday for what? Sir? No, sorry. Sir, I saw it. Were you raising your hand? Ma'am. There was a bomb scare. It luckily did not turn out to be a real bomb, but yes, that's correct. The prosecutor in the trial of former IMF chief Dominique Strauss-Kahn has recommended dropping what charges against the French politician? Sir. That's right. The term they're actually using is aggravated pimping. I'm just reading stuff. I'm not making this up. And because I don't know how to count, we have what? Two left or two. One? Colette? How many left? See, I'm really bad at math.
College.
According to a new poll by Landslide Communications, who is the leading Republican candidate for president among California GOP voters? You wanted to raise your hand there, sir, but you... Anybody want to make a guess? In the back there, yes. No. That's the best guess I think I've heard that is not even on the list. Yes, sir. Are you? Nope, sorry. No. Sir. No. One more chance? No, I'll just give you the answer. It was Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin.
Yeah, right, it was.
Let's do another one. California's Nancy Pelosi is heading up a congressional delegation visiting where? Ma'am. Cuba, that is correct.
Damn it.
You see here? That went very good. Well, listen, we're going to have more news quiz questions and, of course, much more to discuss on Monday, March 2nd, at our next week-to-week political roundtable here at the Commonwealth Club. Thanks to our panel, Bill Whalen and Carla Marinucci. Thank you all here in the audience, listening online, or watching on TV. Have a great week. We'll see you in 2 weeks.